You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jemima Houston tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to the Monday Wire for Rahina, Monday the 5th of August. I'm Jemima, your host, and I'm not quite joined in studio by producer Rahul. He is out doing some special work on the recent, very important announcement that the government made this morning that a bill has been announced to decriminalise abortion and remove it from the Crimes Act. So on the show today, I speak to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the Green Party annual general meeting held over the weekend. Southern Cross is back with the latest in Pacific news. As I mentioned before, Rahul is doing a piece on the abortion bill. He speaks to Terry Balamack from Abortion Law Reform Association New Zealand about Justice Minister Andrew Little's announcement today that abortion will be removed from the Crimes Act and other changes will be made around abortion in New Zealand. And finally, I speak to James Ranstead about the New Zealand Union of Students Association, from the New Zealand Union of Students Association, about Education Minister Chris Hipkins' announcement that vocational education will be reformed. He aho o whakaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai, send through a text to 5395, or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with us on 309 3879. So that's about it. Let's get into it.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
So over the weekend, the Green Party held their annual general meeting. Now, the AGM has raised many questions regarding the transparency of the party's policies and discussions that happened at the meeting, as there was limited media access to the events, and media, leading media and supporters questioning whether the Greens have done enough to be re-elected next term. I spoke to James Shaw about these media and supporters' responses. We also talked a little bit about his recent announcement of a new climate action plan government-wide. So here is James. Just to begin with the AGM, I'm sure you've had a lot of questions about the AGM over the weekend, but I wanted to just check in and ask just generally, how did it all go?
It actually went really well. So, I had a lot of people coming up and saying that they felt re-energised and re-inspired, and in particular ahead of next year, being an election year, people saying it was really good, chance for them to kind of reconnect with, what we've done and what's coming up next. So, yeah, I'm really pleased overall.
So obviously this year there were some questions around the transparency of the event because of the lack of media access to all aspects of the AGM. I know you've explained this by saying that there is a concern that the media continues to paint an unfair caricature of the Green Party. What is this caricature and is it shifting?
Yeah, well, so actually the funny thing is that the format of the conference hasn't changed in years, but I think some of the media got their noses out of joint because they felt that they had to travel all the way to Dunedin to cover a conference that only had sort of three or four open slots, but it's the same number that they normally have. But normally they wouldn't have had to travel so far. So I think that was sort of behind some of the grumpiness that we had from some of the media outlets. I don't think there's a single political party that doesn't close off some sessions because they want to be able to have private conversations away from the glare of the media. I just think that's kind of appropriate. But I also know that, a few years ago, when we were still in opposition, members of the party had just gotten really frustrated at the portrayal of Green Party members as this kind of stereotypical ragged hippie kind of mental image, and didn't feel that that was a fair portrayal. And so I think that they kind of just said, well, if you're going to keep running those sort of stories, we're not really interested in having you in anything other than the most stage-managed sessions. I think that that's changed now that we're in government. We've got a track record. I think people are seeing that you know, we're a very responsible partner in government, and, you know, we're getting the work done. And so maybe that kind of caricature is shifting.
So just talking a little bit about that shift as well, Green Party candidate Jack McDonald stepped down, saying he's concerned that the party is turning centrist under your leadership. What are your thoughts on that? Is there a concern that consistent Green Party voters may view this as well and change their vote?
Well, actually, the members that we've... So we've been surveying people, you know, and members and voters... and saying, well, you know, how do you think we're doing? Actually, the message that we're getting back is people are really pleased with the progress that we're making. Of course, they want to go further, but they also understand that in an MMP environment, where you're not the largest party, that you kind of have to cut your cloth according to your circumstances. And so I think generally the mood's very, very positive. We always knew going into government for the first time that there would be people who couldn't handle some of the compromises that come with being in government. And I think Jack was essentially expressing that kind of concern.
I suppose if the Green Party wants to continue to be in a coalition relationship with the government in next election, you're going to have to continue in this sort of way and have to make those compromises. Do you think that is going to affect voting, or do you think that hopefully people see that that is unfortunately just the reality of MMP and we have to make compromises to make decisions and make things happen?
Well, I think if you look at our polling, you know, it's been rock solid since election night. And that's actually really unusual for a party of government. Usually what happens with smaller parties when they partner up with larger parties to form a government is that their polling collapses and they sort of disappear. And in part that's because, you know, I think their voters have an inflated expectation about what a small party can do. I think our voters are clearly really pragmatic, like they've got that vision and they want to see us implement our policies. But at the same time, they can see that we are developing a pretty good track record of progress. And so my sense is that actually when it comes to the broader electorate next year, that they'll stick with us because they have so far.
Now, you said in your speech at the AGM, this is sort of a diversion to something a little bit different, but talking about climate denial, and you said that climate denial is dangerous, particularly when it comes from government leaders. Can you explain why that is a problem and if that continues, why that is a problem?
Yeah, so what I was saying was that I think that climate denialism has evolved into something actually sort of more insidious in some ways because it sounds so kind of reasonable. It sort of doesn't deny that climate change is happening. It just denies that you need to do anything about it. So what I was saying, you know, is if you look at some of the examples of things that some people have said recently, it's all these kind of soothing words about, you know, how, you know, there isn't a crisis, this isn't a climate emergency, we don't need to incentivize the uptake of electric vehicles, we don't need to put a price on agricultural emissions, we don't need to stop oil and gas exploration. You know, we can basically keep on doing business as usual and somehow climate change will go away. And I think that the point I was making in my speech is I think that is incredibly dangerous thinking because the window of opportunity that we've got to do anything about climate change is closing very rapidly.
And yeah, the concern is that if it is people in leadership positions within the country or in across the world, people are giving that opinion, the public are going to view that and also have that opinion too? Is that sort of the concern that it's a follow-on effect?
Yeah, that's right. Is that, you know, particularly because we all know that, look, I mean, climate change is really inconvenient.
You know, absolutely.
And everybody is, you know, things are going to be different in the future than they are today, whether we choose to do something about it or not. And so, you know, if you're kind of feeling a bit anxious or a bit confused or anything like that, then, you know, it's very easy to be seduced by this notion that it's all fine and you don't really need to do anything different. That comes as quite a relief. It's very believable, very reasonable, sounds reasonable. And so that's why I think it's so dangerous, right? Because, you know, there are many people who are worried about what the future may bring. And you know, you could have you could find that all of the momentum for change starts to peter out and to fizzle because you've got people saying, look, actually, you don't really need to change. You can just keep doing what you've always done.
So continuing on with our climate sort of talk, can you explain your announcement about the Climate Action Plan?
Yeah, so this is the first time that any government has ever had a Climate Action Plan right across the government. And what it comes from is last year, the Productivity Commission wrote us a massive 509-page report with 77 recommendations and dozens of sub-recommendations saying, here's how you shift the economy over the course of the coming 30 years from where we are today to a low-carbon economy. And what we've spent months and months doing, given the size and complexity of their report and recommendations, is going through with the different agencies saying, well, what's our response to those recommendations? And actually, we've come down in favour of all but one of the recommendations. And so what I released on Saturday was the government's response to the Productivity Commission's recommendations and saying, okay, this is what we're intending to do. Here are the responsible agencies, here are the responsible ministers, and here's the timeframe that we're going to be working on each of these things with.
So how is this different to what the government is already doing about the climate emergency?
Well, there is roughly half of the recommendations we actually are already working on. So, you know, I guess having this plan hasn't stopped us from getting on with the job, but it does sort of point to what's next. You know, once we get through the current work program, what are the things that we need to start moving on? And it's really useful, I think, for the public service to have all of that in one place, to say, well, you know, for the sake of completeness, I guess, to be able to say, okay, who's accountable for what? And like I said, no government before has ever had a cross-government climate action plan. It's generally just been the kind of role of the Minister for Climate Change and Ministry for the Environment to kind of chip away on things like the emissions trading scheme. And the rest of government has often pulled in the opposite direction. And so what this is about is making sure that the whole public service is pointed in the same direction.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
What? What the hell?
Yeah, it's turned into a bit of a complicated install.
You've tipped out my undies drawer.
Yep.
My kimchi's gone everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a dog in the sink.
That's heat pumps, mate.
Don't leave it up to some cowboy. First Stop AC and Electrical are your first stop for heat pumps. The full range of models, top quality installations from an experienced team of installers. For a warmer, healthier home, First Stop AC and Electrical. Go to firststop.co.nz or call 0800 178 7867. That's 0800 178 7867.
Tell Dad to bring the car around because it's drive island time. Get amongst it with Johnny and Big Hungry for a very special live drive show with chats, yarns, friends and lovers, Pete from the Surf Report, plus free coffee thanks to Altura Coffee Company and live musical performances from Cream Jean and Carnivorous Plant Society. Hot dog! 95BFM Drive Island, live from Alan Melville Centre, just off High Street. August 16, 4 to 7pm, totally free and all ages thanks to NZ On Air Music.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Rightio, Southern Cross is back, and with me in studio now is Michael Andrew, the Pacific Media Watch contributing editor, and Rahul is with us now as well.
Hi. Cool.
So, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Weird. Did it talk again? I don't know whether that's working very well. Do you want to jump on the blue one?
Okay.
Oh, there we go. Oh, no, there we go. We're in. It's working. Cool. Easy. Panic. Over. Okay. So let's start off with Australia. Australia's Right to Know Media Industry Lobbying Group. Can you talk us through that?
Yes. So this follows the recent
Sorry. We're having mic issues.
Yeah. off, on.
Oh, good.
There we go.
Leave it just there. Yeah,
okay.
Perfect, go.
You've angled it just right.
Lovely.
Yeah, so this follows the recent, attacks on media freedom in Australia over a number of different events, most notably the raids on the ABC headquarters in Sydney from the Australian Federal Police. And that was because they're seeking out whistleblowers and whatnot and trying to crack down on leaks within government agencies. So this media lobby, Australia's Right to Know, has basically submitted a list of recommendations for a complete overhaul of the laws to try and mitigate the what they perceive to be the attack on media freedom in Australia. So it basically, it includes 14 media companies and associations, and it addresses several key issues within the legislation. And the legislation needs to be more soundproof to protect whistleblowers and to prioritise media freedom in a nutshell. So that's a good
step gesture for Australia.
Yeah, and it's good they're making some noise on this, and they've got a unified front to tell the government that what's been happening isn't acceptable, and there needs to be, in a democracy, there needs to be more initiative from the government level to protect whistleblowers.
Absolutely.
And to allow journalists to do the work they can do, because at the moment it's dubious. Like, if a journalist has a leaked document, the law, there's loopholes in the law that allow that journalist to be it's a criminal offence, right? So they just want to make sure, well, if you're going to leak document, that's the journalist's job to have that leaked document. It doesn't matter how he got it or how he or she got it. It's just what they need to do their job and hold the government or whoever's doing the bad stuff accountable. It's very simple. So yeah, it's good. It's a good, like I said, it's a good gesture.
Absolutely.
From the Australian media, yeah.
Perfect. Has there been much response with the government to that? Or
well, it's
really?
Just a proposal at this stage, and it's just over the last weekend, well, the weekend and last week, so not yet, as far as I'm aware, but the ministers are actually saying, yeah, we really need more media freedom and more protection and to protect journalists, but they're not really, it's just like political talk, they're not really putting their money where their mouth is. So it's not like it's openly condemned, like the government's not saying no, journalists shouldn't be reporting on these issues. Like, they're talking the game but not really following through. So this is trying to push
make
through
them
that.
Say something.
Yeah, make them do something a bit more solid.
Yes. So there's been a report about child violence in the Pacific. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah. So this was a report from a bunch of NGOs that looked at child violence across 8 countries in the Pacific. And it was reported quite heavily when the report was released. The Guardian picked it up, RNZ. And it's got some pretty startling numbers. It said there's up to 4 million children across the Pacific are suffering a form
goodness.
Of violence at home.
Yeah.
We had some feedback from experts across the Pacific saying that number seems very high because
yeah.
I don't know, that must be all the children in the Pacific.
Like, yeah.
So I was trying to calculate that. I was thinking, but anyway, it's still an illuminating portrait of the situation, because child violence is certainly an issue. There are cultural issues that I guess enable violence at home that need to be addressed, and it's certainly not a secret that child violence rates in the likes of Papua New Guinea are very abhorrent and very well publicised. So this recommended what needs to be done, kind of that Australia and New Zealand, the big wealthy developed countries, need to find the initiatives to address this, to actually provide the resources, the training, the education to help out. So they need to be more involved in the very sad situation of child violence in the Pacific. So that was that report. As I said, a lot of people, the numbers seem a little bit dubious. So we'll wait and see when that gets a bit recalculated. Mm. But a startling portrait nonetheless.
Absolutely. So shall we move
on
to
questions on child violence?
Yeah.
I'm not an expert. But.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that must be tricky as well. With if there is sort of questions about how many children it is, because how can you sort of I suppose that's what you're waiting for next.
And with questions about giving aid to the Pacific, I suppose that would also have to be done in a culturally competent way and with understanding of, I guess,
how many people it actually is.
It's not just throwing money at
exactly.
the issue. It's a systematic approach.
Completely.
I mean, like we have in
and
New Zealand has
exactly,
massive problems of domestic violence and child violence, and it's not just about welfare or trying to just throw money at it. It's about a systematic response. So as the big brothers of the Pacific, New Zealand and Australia do have a role in that, I'm sure.
Mm.
Mm.
Well, shall we move on to climate crisis, climate emergency, things within the Pacific leaders discussing that?
Yes. Well, this is in line with your conversation with James Shaw before. So the Pacific leaders have, at a forum, declared a climate emergency or climate crisis, and led by Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, and they've basically said if Australia, again, Australia and New Zealand, especially Australia, like a big hint towards Australia, because they mentioned that coal needs to end in the region, and Australia's obviously got coal in their future. So it was a big hint to Australia that if climate change needs to be addressed in the region, then they need to lead it and they need to take more action. It's good to have, again, that unified declaration from those Pacific leaders. But basically I said that we can't really do anything unless the big polluters do anything. It's that same old story that it's up to the big countries, the big developed countries, to really
help out those that can't.
Yeah, take a stand. And also at the Pacific Islands Forum, which Fiji has not been a part of, they've said in the past that the commitments to climate change have kind of been watered down from like the likes of Australia. Mm. So they've got these really hard, emissions commitments, and Australia have allegedly said, well, it's not that big a deal. We don't really need to have these such stringent targets. And all the other Pacific countries kind of follow suit and go, oh, okay, it's not that much of a big deal. So I guess it was a declaration for subsequent forums for Australia and New Zealand to have more of a lead and actually set some very concrete targets to achieve. Mm. Yeah, so that is on the climate change.
Some good climate change things.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a few things today, so I won't talk.
Okay. So should we move on to Indigenous land struggles and media freedom in Malaysia?
Yeah. We don't cover Malaysia very often because it's overshadowed by all the other dire
horrible things
issues,
going on
by neighbouring countries like Indonesia and whatnot, but Malaysia has a very serious deforestation issue with palm oil because they're one of the leading producers and exporters of palm oil in the world, and a lot of their forest has been lost and a lot of their biodiversity, and they have part of Borneo, a massive part of Borneo is Malaysia, and that's one of the most biodiverse places on earth, but this is a story from Peninsula Malaysia. So there is an indigenous people on Peninsula Malaysia called the Orang Asli, and they're the oldest indigenous community. There's about 200,000 of them, and they're leading this active campaign against logging companies to try and stop them from accessing customary land. So this one in this place called Kampung Sungai Papan, in kind of mid Peninsula Malaysia, they put up a blockade to prevent any logging companies coming onto the land and chopping it down and making palm oil. And then this foreign journalist went and reported on it at her own discretion and was taken in by police and then arrested. Essentially, they said they were arresting her, and then they released her a couple of days later. But there were a lot of speculation that it's designed to kind of intimidate and prevent foreign journalists from covering the issue. But I thought I would give it a bit of a plug, because we don't, no one hears about Malaysia all that much, but it does seem like a very dire situation, especially if these indigenous people are the only ones fighting the fight. But fortunately, she was released after the local governor said, no, you have to let her go because we don't want this negative attention. But yeah, definitely, if you are reading news from that region, pay close attention to the deforestation struggle, because Malaysia's a beautiful country with orangutans and whatnot. It's right in the thick of things. So it's important that it gets much attention as possible.
Yeah, and that does seem sort of sad that it's only, I mean, 200,000 people seems a lot, but it's only those people really fighting for it.
Yeah.
When I'm sure hundreds and thousands of other people aren't doing anything, or the government isn't doing anything. And yeah, interesting as well, again, that journalist was released because they don't want bad press.
Yeah.
It's interesting that is a constant theme, that journalists are constantly released because they don't want anyone looking badly at what they've been doing.
It's a good thing that they get released, because journalists have spent years in jail.
They shouldn't be put in jail in the first place. But
best of both worlds, to both intimidate journalists but yet not get any bad press for doing so.
So this was kind of a good outcome, because perhaps if that journalist wasn't arrested, it wouldn't have got the attention it did.
True.
But I couldn't find it reported in many foreign papers. It was all domestic. So I don't know if this issue is getting much getting much press time, but
within Malaysia as well, where the media is reporting it within Malaysia.
Yeah, but Malaysia's quite far. I mean, I've been there and I've read the newspapers, and it's very pro palm oil. They're obsessed with palm oil. It's like
it's bringing so much money. Yeah,
but the flip side is it just loses what's beautiful about that place. And I don't think there's that much emphasis on preserving the forest and preserving the biodiversity. It's not that known that it's such a, that's what it's known for. So but good story.
Yeah, good story. Yeah. And then we'll move on finally to some PMC Ihu Matau coverage.
Yes, so we had one of our reporters, or a classmate of mine, Charlotte Muru Lanning, who went down there, and she's been covering it quite closely, and she found out through one of her contacts that the websites that the iwi who are opposing the occupation, Te Kawaro Aumaki, they had set up these Facebook pages that looked very much like Souls, Save Our Landscapes,
really?
Facebook pages, and there was a lot of criticism that was a deliberate tactical move to kind of confuse
people. Get
people
to click onto the wrong thing.
Yeah, and they
both
have the similar slogan, Protect Ihu Matau and Protecting Ihu Matau. So a bit of tactical social media there. But those pages were removed Friday morning, probably because of the criticism. A spokesperson from Seoul said, they would have been getting a lot of flack for it. And also their website was when you do a Google search, it comes up first. So they obviously paid a little bit more to have it popped up. And the website itself, it kind of says, oh, the deal we have with Fletcher's is really, really good. And it's basically lauding the relationship that the iwi have with Fletcher's, and it's doing wonders and whatnot. So kind of interesting, the politics within the
social media.
So she did a story on that, and I don't think anyone else covered it, but it was quite interesting to have that insight into the internal politics of the whole thing.
Fascinating. It's so tricky, using that clickbait sort of wall to sort of click if you see something, because you've seen your friend say post something about Seoul on Instagram, and then you see something similar on Facebook, and you're like, oh yeah, this must be the same thing.
Yeah.
And you get led on a completely different track.
Subtle marketing.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. But that's it. That's a wrap.
Yeah. Well, read all about Pacific Media Centre updates at asiapacificreport.nz. Thank you so much, Michael, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
That was the Southern Cross.
on the house kids.
Was Licking Letters by The Mint Chicks. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Andrew Little has today announced the Labour Party's proposed abortion bill, which would decriminalise abortion in New Zealand and introduce changes to make abortion more accessible. The changes come in response to the Law Commission's advice regarding reform, and the bill will have its first reading this Thursday. Andrew Little explains what the bill will entail.
Having counselling will not be mandatory for women chooses not to have that. Next, the law will enable women to self-refer to an abortion service provider. They will not have to have that brokered through their GP. Next, the bill will provide for a regulation-making power to establish safe zones on a case-by-case basis. So it won't be established from the outset, but the Minister of Health will have the power on application by an abortion service provider or a DHB to establish a safe zone in a place where one is considered necessary. The next aspect of the legislation will be that relate to conscientious objection by health practitioners. So if a health practitioner has a conscientious objection to providing abortion services, then they will be required to refer the pregnant woman in practical terms, to the Ministry of Health, that will have information available to women on where to go to get an abortion. And then finally, in relation to the remaining criminal aspects in relation to this, it will remain a crime, of course, for somebody who is not a qualified health practitioner to offer abortion services. And then finally, for someone who assaults a pregnant woman that leads to the loss of the fetus, that will remain a crime as it is at the moment under our Crimes Act. As well as aiming to have the first reading of the bill on this Thursday, I'll also be proposing that Parliament establish a specific select committee to consider the legislation. And we will move accordingly in the House this week. I think that the best way that we can get a good public debate going is to get the bill in the House, to get through the first reading, to get the select committee established, and then to get submissions and the public debate going about the appropriate next step in terms of the reform of this law.
Andrew Little also fielded some questions from reporters about the bill.
He said that the health practitioners were nearly unanimous in their support of option A.
Can you say that this is still a health approach when you're going against their advice by going for essentially a watered-down version of option C?
Yes, I can, because as I just said, 98% of abortions happen in the first 16 weeks of pregnancy, so we're talking about a very small number. This is about making the shift from the criminal framework to the health framework that still remains even with a 20-week threshold.
Will the ground for that practitioner have to consider, will they be set in law, or as they currently are, the ground that a practitioner can consider a very specific set of law?
Yeah, so the wording will be along the lines that the health practitioner has to reasonably believe that the abortion is appropriate with regard to the pregnant woman's physical and mental health and her well-being.
Speaking about law, as your coalition partners, do you know if Consumer Affairs will support the bill or see it as a conscious issue?
Well, it will be a conscious issue anyway, so each MP is free to vote how they wish. But New Zealand First in the discussions has been very constructive, very positive, and in fact, we've got the bill to the point that it is with the support that they've given.
I spoke to National President of the Abortion Law Reform Association New Zealand, Terry Bellamack, about her thoughts on how well this bill approaches what New Zealand needs for abortion reform. I started by asking...
Well, it looks like the abortion is going to be decriminalised. It's great. That's huge right there. We were hoping that the government would select Model A because, I mean, it's the one the option that treated abortion most like health care. They went for something like Model C, actually Model C, but with a 20-week limit instead of a 22-week limit, which, you know, perhaps they have to do that for their coalition partners. You know, even though they've gone for Model C, this is still such a huge improvement on the system we have right now that we really have to give the government props for that. It looks like self-referral is in there, which is great. That's going to make a huge difference to people who are trying to access abortion care, because, you know, getting that referral was often a big hurdle to jump through, or to jump over rather. And it's great that you can refer yourself directly into a service. It looks like places that provide abortions will no longer need to have special license, which is great. Overall, I think the best thing is that, you know, we're even having this discussion, that we've even got this far. It's amazing. Today's a great day.
Option A and Option C, what you're referring to there is, of course, the Law Commission report, which suggested three different options regarding how abortion law could be reformed.
So Model A was a situation where the pregnant person would consult with their doctor and decide on an abortion between the two of them. And that's it. There was no statutory test that needed to be satisfied. Under Model B, there was a statutory test that needed to be satisfied, and the doctor who was providing the abortion care would be the person to make that decision and to give their approval. That was the model that's most like what we've got now. Model C was like Model A up until 22 weeks, and like Model B after 22 weeks.
Given that the government has gone with an option that looks, as you said, much like Option C, do you find an element of this bill disappointing?
Well, you know, it's a little disappointing, but I would say it's a little disappointing that they didn't go with Model A in the first place. But that said, there's a lot of good stuff in this bill.
The government has also suggested that they would propose there to be a special committee. Do you think that there is a chance that the bill will change over the course of its readings to a form where it is perhaps more agreeable and more in line with Option A?
I think that's going to largely depend on the select committee and what they hear from New Zealanders. So if New Zealanders, you know, want changes to this bill, you know, if they want Model A and they're loud enough about it, I think the select committee would probably listen. That's going to depend, too, on how much influence they have over their MPs.
The vote will be a conscientious vote throughout the entirety of the bill's readings. Do you think Labor has done enough to create enough cross-party support for this bill such that the bill should pass?
Yeah, I think the bill should definitely pass under any and all circumstances. I mean, it's so much better than what we have now. It would be legislative malpractice not to pass.
Is there anything else this bill misses out on? Or?
Well, I'm a confused about the bill's recommendations around conscientious objection, and I really hope that someone asks the minister about it, because I'm just not sure how different it is from what we have right now, and I'd like to find out more.
Do you think the way conscientious objection currently works is something that should be reformed?
Yes, absolutely. Right now, conscientious objection on the patient, it's the burden is way out of balance in favor of the doctor. I know what I would like to see. I would like to see, in terms of conscientious objection, I would like to see I would like to see doctors and pharmacists and to be required to refer their patients immediately to people who would help them, either get contraception or for an abortion referral, or for emergency contraception, or whatever service they require. I would like to see a person who consults a physician and gets refused a service not to have to pay for that consultation. I would like to see a list of providers and what they refuse to do, perhaps in the care of the medical council or the health ministry.
And is there anything else at all you'd like to add about the bill or about your response to the bill?
It's great that we've come this far. I mean, it's long past time that, women and pregnant people, need to be able to feel safe and in control of their own lives. It's really great that we've come this far. But we need to get it across the line, otherwise it's not going to help anybody.
Irirangi Paul, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Students have come out in support of the Minister of Education, Chris Hipkins' announcement on the reform of vocational education, as the higher level statements are so far in step with in the right direction towards fulfilling the ROVE student wish list. I spoke to James Ranstead, the National President for the New Zealand Union of Students Associations, about this decision. We discussed what the wish list is, whether the reform truly meets the wishes of those students in vocational education, and how the reform may affect students currently enrolled and students wishing to be enrolled at a later date. Here is James.
Sure thing. So the Minister of Education has put forward a proposal to merge all New Zealand's independent 16 institutes of technology and polytechnics into one large national institute. The reasons for this largely the fact that the number of students in the ITP, studying in the ITP space in New Zealand have dropped significantly over the past decade as a result of falling school leaver numbers, but more importantly for the vocational sector, really high employment. And so people aren't encouraged to get involved in vocational education as much as what they previously were. And so with 16 independent polytechnics getting less students, they've been struggling financially. So the purpose of this, amongst many other secondary purposes, the main one is to make it more resilient to fluctuating student numbers.
Now, there has been student support to this reform. Can you explain why this reform was necessary and why students are on board?
Yeah, sure thing. So, for one, I mean, up until this point in time, the polytech sector has largely been driven by student numbers. And so in many of our regions where people are often not highly educated and would benefit hugely from having good, adequate regional provision, oftentimes the services and the educational facilities aren't there for them. And we've seen a drop away of that in some areas for the likes of Unitech up in Auckland, in Wellteck and Whitsuntide, Taupo Tini down on the west coast of the South Island as well. A number of their programs have been cut simply because they haven't been able to financially stand on their own two feet. There's other secondary benefits as well. I mean, for example, by having multiple different campuses throughout the country, it's a lot easier to transfer across different campuses if one student, say, wanted to study in Wellington and shift up to Hamilton, for example. Another key benefit would also run along the lines of making sure that campuses aren't competing against one another and really taking a national approach to ensure that the right resources and the right course offerings are in the right space and concentrating that there. Yeah.
So will this change affect those students currently studying, or will it only affect students enrolled after this change comes into effect?
So there will likely be very minimal changes to those students that are studying, but we recognise that those students that are considering studying and will be in the sector over the next 2 to 3 years, there probably will be some quite significant changes. We are a political lobbying body, so one of the key things that we've been pushing for from the Minister is to ensure that there is as much transparency and certainty provided to students over the next few years in regards to their program changes. Over the past couple of years, we've seen at WATEC today a number of different, which is the Polytechs in Wellington, a number of different program and course changes, and a number of students have felt really ripped off from the changes. So we're really keen to ensure that this process, change process, is managed as smooth as possibly.
How can you ensure that those changes are transparent? Is it sort of just continual reminders to the government that that's what students need, or is there something more, I don't know, more concrete that you can ensure that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, clear communication is the key one. Along with that too is having goals and outlines early on. I mean, for example, a student in secondary school considering doing some form of engineering at their local polytech, if that course, say, isn't going to be offered in a year or 2 years' time, they should be told about that as early as possible rather than then pinning their hopes. So that's just an example, but I think you kind of get the gist of what I'm going along.
There's been talk about the ROVE wish list. Can you explain what this is?
Yeah, I mean, we believe that students are the most important, along with industry and all the other bodies, but we would say that students are the most important stakeholder within the reform of vocational education. There is approximately 100,000 students within the vocational space in New Zealand, so we're really keen to ensure that students do get a good deal out of these changes. So we've put together a list of 10 different items that we've titled our vocational education student wish list. And they range from a variety of different things, many of which we've touched on. So ensuring there's proper regional provision, making sure the transitions are smooth as possible, and making sure that education is as flexible and suited towards the 21st century learner. We've also touched on a few other key points around student voice. Since the polytech sector has been struggling financially over the past decade, but also tied in with the likes of voluntary student membership, student voice is really been on the lowdown over the past decade in particular, and they've really been hammered by reduction in funding and resourcing put towards their student voice. So we're really keen to make sure that democratic structures and the resourcing to back that up are put into the student voice in polytech space.
You've said there have been some wishes that have been met by the reform, but how are we going to ensure that those other wants and needs are met in the future for students?
Yeah, sure thing. So the announcement is just that so far, an announcement. And so that announcement covered 5 of the 10 key items in our wish list. Yes, they are just statements in this point in time, and we'd really like to make sure that they actually do come to fruition. We also recognise the announcements are incredibly high level, and so much of what we include within our wish list was relatively detailed. So we're not necessarily hugely frustrated at this point in time. We recognise a lot of this detail will be fleshed out over time. So, but we just put it here to front foot the decision making process as they go through the transition of the reform of vocational education. So that's through the likes of how the student voice will be set up, and around the likes of the free tertiary education fee-free policy as well, which we've tacked on as the number 10. We're going to be pushing all 10 points in this wish list, but it'll also really encourage those students studying in vocational education to, have a look at this wish list and also push for the items within their own institute because, the more people saying it and more people singing from the song sheet is really going to increase the chances of then coming to fruition and students getting a really good deal out of this reform of vocational education.
Obviously, you've said this is an announcement. Are groups like yours and like other groups within various polytechnics and across New Zealand, do you think they're actually going to have the ability to have consultation with the government on this, or do you think that that's sort of unlikely and it's more that we just all need to speak loudly about it and hopefully they'll listen?
Yeah, so between now and the 1st of April, they're establishing a transition board made up of 10 key individuals from the form of vocational education space. Unfortunately, students, there is not a student rep on that, so that is disappointing for us. At the same time, though, the Minister has said that he expects there to be a huge amount of consultation and a student advisory group being set up for this transition board as well. So we're really keen to jump on that bandwagon and make sure that this wish list and the students' interests in general are fed through to that transition board and beyond 1st of April 2020 as well.
That was The Wire.
That was The Wire for Monday this week. Thank you very much to everyone who spoke with us for the show today. Thank you very much to Rahul for being a wonderful producer and to Lillian for helping behind the scenes. We will talk to you next week on Monday. Have a good afternoon out there and have a lovely, lovely week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.